Welcome to the Townships at 12. I'm Maureen Dillon Teasdale, and I will be with you for the next hour here on theCUBE, 88.9 FM, CJMQ. In today's show, I will be speaking with Joseph Cianflone. He is the leader of the Canadian Party of Quebec. We will hear part one of the interview in the first part of the show, and we will hear part two of the interview in the second part of the show. As usual, I will have lots of announcements for community events coming up, some health news, and some music. We will start today's show with Tom Cochran, and the song is called Big League. Today we're speaking with Joseph Cianflone, the leader and co-founder of the Canadian Party of Quebec, or CAPQ, the only provincial party that openly champions Canadian unity, bilingualism, and democratic accountability here in Quebec. A proud Canadian and Quebecer, Joseph is a Harvard and Oxford graduate with a strong background in global healthcare leadership. He's worked with innovative health technology companies to improve system performance and patient care both in Canada and abroad. Now, as leader of the CAPQ, he brings that same forward thinking and solutions-driven approach to politics, emphasizing inclusion, modernization, and the protection of constitutional rights for all Quebecers. We're pleased to have him with us today to talk about his political vision, the role of the Canadian Party of Quebec, and what he hopes to bring to the province's future. I'm Maureen Dillon Teasdale for theCUBE, and today I'm really pleased to welcome Joseph Cianfloni. He is the leader of the Canadian Party of Quebec. So welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Maureen. And you did a great job. I guess I usually go for the less biblical Joe and then Cianfloni for the last name. So appreciate it.
Okay. Now tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm a born Montrealer, Quebecer, Canadian. Just in my early 40s now, so grew up around kind of Mount Royal, Villemard, Vilsaint. We're all kind of all over Montreal, and ultimately in the West Island. Family's got roots in Quebec for a few hundred years, back to Capelton over in the Eastern Townships, and then kind of migrated towards the Montreal city center early 20th century. Got a little brother, two wonderful parents, pretty big family, multi-generational, like I said, Quebecer-Canadian family. So we've always had a really nice spread of people, identity, cultures, all the things that make, Quebec a vibrant and unique place. So that's, me, a little bit about me on the personal side. On the educational journey, I was an EMSB student at Marymount Academy and NDG, and then I finished off high school here in St. Thomas and the Lester B. Pearson School Board over in the West Island. Got a scholarship to Upper Canada College, so I did that instead of CEJA, and then did my undergraduate degree in economics and mathematics at Harvard University, and a Master of Science in Financial Economics at Oxford afterwards. Along that journey, sort of always been very socially and community interest minded. Actually started my undergraduate degree in philosophy and mathematics, intending to do a healthcare access thesis pre-med. And then I realized I was really much more interested in access and provision and sort of healthcare economics. So after school, I got into investment, knowing that I really wasn't too involved or implicated in any specific industry. And I loved really solving problems and making sure society was being efficient. So I did that for a lot of years, just kind of helping good companies get access to capital and really make sure that they grow and have impact in society. And that was very rewarding. Ultimately, what brought me back here to work for the federal government for the Public Sector Pension Investment Board, where I was an analyst on a couple of different portfolios and then ran a few portfolios myself. And then since 2019, I've been an executive, effectively a chief financial officer in more impact spaces. Just started with a green tech company here in Dorval in Quebec, and then I've been working in healthcare since 2022, which is kind of wonderful to bring it back full circle to sort of what I started in terms of my social and academic interests, which is getting people good healthcare efficiently and effectively.
Impressive background. Now, could you tell our listeners a little bit about the Canadian Party of Quebec and how it began and what inspired you to help to found it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's a multi-step story, if you'll bear with me, but a sort of personal friend of mine, Colin Standish, had been working on some language activism causes here in Quebec for quite a while. We connected kind of 2019, 2020 online, just seeing sort of the lay of the land and the trends in play. Pretty concerned with the nature of all the unanimous voting behind identity resolutions within Assemblée Nationale and the CAC, despite having promised not to open any language files or create new laws and get everyone a primary care doctor, kind of trending very differently. And then when, sort of the Trudeau Liberals really started looking to make political hay with Bill C-13 and Melanie Joly's proposal or re-proposal of Balcair's asymmetric rights, we got really worried. And so, we kept in touch, and we maybe were some of the only people who read Bill 96 before commenting on it the day it came out. And that was kind of the genesis. We're like, wow, this is kind of the beginning of the end of democracy. It's been flirted with as a political strategy here in Quebec by many parties who use it to win. And I think fundamentally know that they don't really mean the things they say. But we sort of reached the point where what's happening de jure and on paper and the legislative implications of this next level of political haymaking are fundamentally redrawing the social contract between the individual and the government. So first thing we did is we founded the Task Force on Linguistic Policy, and we maybe naively hoped that injecting the right information and sort of objective figures and really making sure people understood they need to think in terms of costs and benefits and not just one side of those or even direct mythologies might actually help sort of pivot the public dialogue. I think we had a reasonable amount of success raising some of the issues, if not getting, you know, sort of recognition on our end for it, which was never the point. By the time the CAC was sort of publishing full page articles in the Montreal Gazette saying there will be no changes to healthcare. And, you know, obviously we had filed a 130-page deposition at the Assemblée Nationale. And again, I think just actually read the bill. It's really not that hard to read. It references 22 other pieces of legislation, which is frustrating, but the language is pretty clear in terms of what it's doing. So it was always interesting to see that denialism. So we did that. And with the task force, we did the outreach to, you know, I'm glad at the time and a number of sitting MNAs right now, people outside the party, you know, basically people outside the province, reached out to the other parties, you know, that they weren't really acceptant of any sort of meetings or briefings. We went through that exercise and we realized that there was, you know, effectively no, that there was really no one who was going to stand up for, I mean, I want to call it principle, but we really are at the basis for the preconditions of having a democracy. And that kind of spurred a separate level of thinking for us. So, you know, the task force thing's been very successful pivoting towards continual public information campaigns, but also making sure the right legal challenges are happening and for the right reasons, i.e. for the merits of the law and for the omnibus use of the notwithstanding clause, as opposed to technicalities that might postpone implications for certain groups or impacted people. We all have a philosophical disagreement with this being fundamentally undemocratic and illegal law. So we've left that challenge kind of with the task force on the court level. And I think what really impressed, that whole experience impressed upon me, I mean, culminating in the Attorney General for the Government of Canada showing up to, you know, a hearing last year with the Constitution Act and Bill 96 stapled to it, while still contorting in their testimony to say they have not accepted Bill 96 as part of the Constitution of Canada via no contest, which is effectively what they've done, and every other province has wisened up to and started doing themselves as well. So we saw the snowballing, and you know that's really kind of, and looking forward to that future was really what brought the party about, that we need direct intervention in the political system. We can't change first past the posts, which is always going to undermine any sort of democratic expression in Quebec, as well as any fair media characterization of where 90% of the population is at politically. And it is 90%, right? We see 11% of Quebecers who don't believe they're Canadian or feel that that's an important part of their identity. And yet that undertone, you know, and the idea of Quebec as a answer to Canada and the Quebec identity as a negative sign in front of Canada's just underlines all the policy and party identities we see in Quebec. So that's the long-winded story of how we get here in multiple steps, you know, kind of just looking for better options and they're not being it.
You were unanimously elected leader at the 2025 convention, and congratulations on that. And what did that leadership moment mean to you personally and politically?
You know, they say it takes 10 years to be an overnight success. So hopefully we're 5 years into that, and you know, 5 years you're activating on the next 5 years of driving change. But I've never aspired to be a politician. I don't think I am a politician. I have a political role to play here. Longer term, there'll be better politicians than me who lead this party. But you know, the importance of it for me personally is that we are running out of time. These are not new issues that we're experiencing in healthcare, in education. As an economist, you know, you watch this stuff and it takes decades to sort of mistrain, misincentivize, missystematize these systems and fail to adjust, adapt, and evolve with the rest of the world, because we cut ourselves off from it so effectively in our governmental thinking and project planning. My concern, and the reason I do this, is because I really do think we are in the 11th hour. And when we start talking about referendum, it's so frustrating, because the same people driving a complete political impasse for 50 years in our politics, I mean, it really is a matter of political neglect. You know, the only ones being catered to by this political system, ostensibly according to them, to make Quebec stronger, well, they just weaken it at every possible step because of who ends up participating in provincial government. And we have narrowed down that population. I mean, there's a lot of amazing Quebecers out there, and I'd love to see them actually participate in government, as opposed to just leave it to whoever will. And that's, I think, it's a real cultural problem we have to confront, that, you know, our provincial government has really broken faith with the population. I think most people do not feel a social contract in this province anymore and question the validity of this government. I think it's a natural response to a first past the post system that effectively, if you do the math, we've got these governments winning with 30 to 40% of votes, with 40% voting, and a good 10, 15% of our population ineligible to vote, whether they're temporary, whether they're children, et cetera. I mean, these parties are all fighting over 10 to 15% of the population that are still engaged in this toxic provincial politics. And if we don't change it, there is no real hope for any of our values, any of our systems, any of our families. Like I said, I see a lot of opportunism. I see a lot of incrementalism. Everyone is up in arms now about Bill 1 and the Constitution, but you know, I'm pretty sure we just had a Quebec Liberal Party leadership race where we're all for the idea. This is the cycle that has to stop. Cannot keep accommodating nonsense, right? We can respect people's views and still have vision, leadership, and integrity in defending basic principles. It's okay to tell people they're wrong, but you respect that they have passion. But it's not okay to keep pretending that any of it makes sense.
Now, the Canadian Party of Quebec, you're openly defending Canadian unity, bilingualism, and democratic accountability. What does that look like in practice, though? And why do you think that message resonates with some Quebecers today?
Yeah, I think it's more than Quebecers. So, you know, if you look at the numbers, sure, it's most Quebecers, right? Like we said, sort of 89% Quebecers view being Canadian as a critical part of their identity, right? More or less. Now, that's a pretty good response for anywhere, to be honest. But this is beyond Quebec, right? What we have, unfortunately, is, you know, we've allowed a debate to emerge on total nonsense in terms of multiculturalism and redefining these words into sort of tribal concepts. The very truth that we need to own is simple. Unlike the Americans, it didn't happen in a single declaration, but between, let's call it 1760 and 1867, and particularly between 1830 and 1867, what we created was Canadian exceptionalism, right? A nationality that puts to bed, as the patriots, you know, clearly wrote and advocated for, any concept of European attachment to English versus French nationalism. That defines being Canadian as our cohesive nationality with equal access to all the rights and benefits of being Canadian in either official language. And by the way, no real pretense at that time of trying to exclude other people because of their languages either. And so I think what we've had is basically at least 3.5 decades, I'd say after NAFTA, like very little defense of our Canadian culture, heritage, and identity, which is as simple as that. That like the United States, like other countries that are post-colonial, we don't define your citizenship based on your identity, your religion, your race, your creed. Now, the Quebec government is trying to do that, indeed, with Bill 1 and this concept of the Quebec nation and having a government that is only responsible to the members it elects are eligible to be part of this Quebec nation. This is obviously another non-democratic concept. But that ultimately is kind of where I think we need to move the debate if we're going to see anything positive happen.
Now, you have an impressive background in global health and technology. How has your experience in those sectors shaped your approach to political leadership?
I mean, it's really galvanized me that this Canadian Inc., Quebec Inc. view of sort of incrementalism like has to change. You know, you can talk to anyone in the healthcare system, especially the one still using 1980s DOS-based communications platform, right? We have got to get serious about reform. And it's not through sort of playing nice and pretending that doing little or doing nothing is meaningful. So in that vacuum of celebrating Canadian culture as this thing that brings us all together to do the best for our people, and with the further vacuum of a healthcare system here in Canada that's completely publicly driven and so lacks that push for innovation and accountability for its results, I've just lived the opposite in many different countries, trying so much more significantly with much less resourcing to do better in healthcare. And I think that's what's lost on a lot of people is that we have the second most costly healthcare system in the world. We're, you know, in the bottom tier of 35 public healthcare systems in terms of provision. And that's our public statistics. If you talk to someone who's been waiting for a healthcare doctor for, you know, for primary care physician for 7 years or more, and the entire time the CAC has promised to fix the problem, you know, they're not too concerned about the aggregate statistics. They have no healthcare. Right, we like to pretend paying the taxes for it means we all have healthcare, but many people have no healthcare in Canada. So it's very much galvanized me. I've seen the way we characterize other systems and mischaracterize what those experiences are like. We use it towards inaction, and we just can't afford it anymore. We've got, I'm part of a sandwich generation, so I've got my younger son, he's 2.5. I've got my stepkids who are you know, between 17 and 22. And I've got parents who are 78, 88, and I've seen a lot of long-term care facilities across my great aunts and uncles and, you know, different levels of dignity in their end of life. And this shouldn't be with the amount of money we put at this, right? This is just a matter of poor planning, poor accountability, and really, quite frankly, at its core, very little will to radically change the system for the better, even when we don't have to guess, right? We can learn from the experience of other systems, and it seems like we almost try not.
Now, one of the things that brought you into public life was your work with the Task Force in Linguistic Policy, which challenged Bills 96 and 21. Why did you feel it was important to take a public stand on those issues?
Well, I think you could just see the underlying theme, right? I mean, politicians like to silo, you know, individual things and kind of create evaluative context that might not be as connected to their real world realities. Like, you know, these things impact people. So look at Bill 21, kind of outright anti-ethnic sentiment, anti-immigrant sentiment. Bill 40 was also important for us, another attack on democracy and the rights of the English speaking community here to express itself democratically. And then Bill 96 just came out and said it in the first two pages, right? The Quebec government really has no obligation to anyone who isn't part of the Quebec nation. And if you don't live your public life in French, and now they keep talking about our houses as well. So basically, if you don't live your life in French, you're not part of the Quebec nation. Right? None of that is democratic. None of that is legal in this country, right? And we've just normalized the use of an escape clause in the Constitution, the notwithstanding clause, meant for war times and, you know, periods of significant crisis, and meant as a temporary relief from still having to design better systems and laws than what comes out when you exempt them from basic non-discrimination. We just sort of threw that out the window, right? So, you know, again, the commentary in all of our media and the pundits and the part is just so incredibly irresponsible as to the implications of allowing this to continue. And of course, that's what's happened since 2019. It starts small. It starts with symbolic nonsense, you know, nonsense symbolic motions in the Assemblée Nationale that MNAs will say, oh, it's not worth fighting over. But when you're kind of denying that the Patriots fought for Canada, not for this Quebec, and you're sort of publishing, you know, anti-bilingual and anti-Canadian motions, and you can pretty much tell in a system where, again, 10% of the population gets 100% of the power, what's going to come next legislatively. And here we are. Constant erosion of the social contract, the constant erosion of, I don't even think you can call Quebec a democracy at this point. The fact that we have votes doesn't make it a democracy, right? An individual's protection from the government is what makes a democracy. The freedoms make a democracy, and we've undermined all of that for some collective concept that also doesn't exist in any democracy. They like to invoke, you know, that this is how it works in France, but it's not at all. The French legal system has three tiers of rights. And just like Pierre Elliott Trudeau did here, you establish positives, collective rights, not negative attacks on other communities, through individual rights. So like the French right to be served in Quebec, right? You know, and that's how you create collective rights. You don't create an arbitrary body and say, this is above everyone, and the discretionary people who represent it get to decide. Right? That's straight authoritarianism. We know what this is, you know, those of us who've studied history. We don't need to repeat that either.
You're listening to The Townships at 12 on CJMQ 88.9 FM, better known as The Cube. I'm your host, Maureen Dillon Teasdale. We just heard part one of my interview with Joseph Cianflone. He is the leader of the Canadian Party of Quebec. And we will hear part two of the interview in the second part of my show today. And next up, we have some community event announcements for you. The Sunnyside Elementary School will be hosting a holiday bingo taking place at Sunnyside Elementary School in the gymnasium located at 441 Rue Dufferin Street in Stanstead on Saturday, November 29th, and entrance is free. The event is fully bilingual. Everybody is welcome. They will be selling bingo cards at the door, and there will also be door prizes, a 50-50 raffle, and a canteen with snacks and drinks. The prizes will be fantastic. They have received generous donations from many local businesses to make the event even more exciting. All proceeds will go toward funding their Santa shop for the kids, supplementing school supplies, and supporting end-of-year activities. And again, that is at Sunnyside Elementary School, and that happens on Saturday, November 29th. St. Mark's Chapel Festival of Lessons and Carols. The chapel is located on Bishop's University campus Friday, November 28th, 7 p.m. and Saturday, November 29th at 4 p.m. Under the direction of Sarah Heath, the St. Mark's Chapel Choir hosts their annual Festival of Lessons and Carols. Enjoy traditional Christmas music at the special candlelit service. A freewill offering to be collected. Parking on campus is free for this event. Everyone is welcome. Ayerscliff Elementary School Home and School Association Christmas Market. That happens on Saturday, November 29th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. The school is located at 952 Sanborn Street in Ayerscliff. And it's time again for Lennoxville Elementary School, their annual Spaghetti Supper Fundraiser. This year it's on Friday, December 5th, 4:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. The school is located on Academy Street in Lennoxville. This year's proceeds will be going toward their new playground. Tickets sold at the door, $15 for those 13 years and up, $10 for those 6 to 12-year-olds, and it's free for 5-year-olds and under. Everyone in the community is welcome. Cash only. There will be a Christmas market on December 6, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Lennoxville United Church, located at 6th Church Street in Lennoxville. Christmas concert to feed the needy. Entrance is free. Voluntary donation box at the door on Saturday, December 6, 6:30 p.m. at St. Patrick's Church, located at 20 Gordon Street in Sherbrooke. Performing Valerie Crete and Francois Lopri, Esther Bouchard and Manon Blouin. There's a book sale coming up Saturday, December 6th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. This is hosted by the Lennoxville Library. It will be at the Amity Beaudoin Community Center, 10 Samuel Gratham Street in Lennoxville. It opens at 10 a.m. and goes until 3 p.m. Hundreds of books in both French and English, most just $1 or $2. Fiction, nonfiction, children's books, and more. Plus, discover rare and collectible items. In the last hour, there's a deal. Fill a bag for just $10. Cash or debit card. There will be a Christmas bazaar at Sherbrooke Elementary School. That happens on Saturday, December 6, 8:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. There's a bistro, bake table, silent auction, new to you, scholastic book fair, Kitty Corner and raffles, and the dance club and the choir will perform at 11 a.m. That's Sherbrooke Elementary School, located at 242 Ontario Street in Sherbrooke. You're listening to The Cube 88.9 FM, and this is The Townships at 12. I'm your host, Maureen. We will take a break and hear the news with Derek Bullard, and we will be right back with part two of The Townships at 12. And in part two today, I will be airing the second part of the interview I did with the leader of the Canadian Party of Quebec, Joseph Cianfloni. We will close part one with Arcade Fire, Wake Up.